And so it's a little awkward, you know, when you have to pop your head up this way and, or in some way do it this way on a pillow in order to have sufficient circulation. But it works for about 3 to 4 hours. That's the situation. Anyway, I'm learning little by little because this is the best year I've had in terms of being able to rest some every night apart from being just in a chair. Other nights, I simply had to get up. I couldn't stay there more than seconds, and I realized I wasn't getting enough air. So those are the peculiar things. That doesn't mean I'm about to die, because I'll, you know, you simply get better. The pollen is over, and it's now a matter of avoiding certain foods until the body thinks there are no more enemies, and then it quiets down. The cause of it seems to be found in cases, now not that every case of this leads to a condition such as asthma, but that people who have this problem almost always have the same background that I did. Either the mother cannot nurse the child, or the child was given something other than mother's milk, especially solids, before 6 months. And that was my condition. But you don't always reap it when you're little. And the fact is, probably I wouldn't know I had this possibility if we hadn't moved in this delightful Olive Grove area. I would just never had it before. Anyway, I found also that the fact is, I found that in addition to olive pollen, the desert pollen, I don't know whether these plants out here would cause it or not. I haven't noticed anything here, by the way, but I can have a severe reaction to desert plants in Southern California in the interior desert. And when those winds come in that we call the satanic winds or the Santanas, that you call the Chinook winds or something like that, those bring pollens, and it is a problem. So, today I would like to comment on another thing just before. First of all, I'm very happy to see Mr. and Mrs. Harold Smith here. I want to give the best wishes of all the friends you may have in Pasadena area. I will be going, not my wife, to the Big Sandy campus this next week and for commencement and then the college board meeting on Sunday. In the meantime, I want to extend also the Engelbart best wishes to you as near neighbors. I was scheduled to be here Saturday and Sunday, and Mr. Engelbart used his weight, shall we say, to inveigle our staying there, and church administration agreed that it was enough that you hear me one day and that Tacoma should hear me the other. But I'm very happy to be here and to get to know you. I want to thank Mr. Harold Smith and his wife for their hospitality. And for those of you who prepared such a very nice meal, I really did appreciate the Thai cuisine and or related cuisine to that of that region that some of you prepared. One of the dishes was a perfect combination. Most Thai foods present no problem because I can make a choice during the season of the year because rice is no problem. And as long as I stay away from certain things, I know enough of Thai food that I don't have any problem in making general choices. But one dish was especially nice, which had no difficulty whatsoever. But my wife won't mind saying, I fell in love twice. Once with her and the other with Thai cooking. I have never had an experience like that. I went to Thailand on Mr. Armstrong's behalf with some others, and the first meal we had at the Rama Hilton Hotel, I simply found that I had never enjoyed the culinary art of any people equal to what I had there. And I have for a long time, I only dreamed about it because it took some time to discover the Thai community in Southern California. But it is truly a remarkable achievement. It's like saying a peasant people marching through the forest out of China to Thailand came to raise a peasant's food to the level of a royal art. That's the best way to describe it, because it is the simple forest food, bark, leaves, herbs, in addition to the simple rices and vegetables. And it has been done in such a way that it is regarded as one of the world's great cuisines today. Thailand, I'll just take a moment of time and say, remarkably, has had a relationship with the United States of America longer than some nations of Europe. The Rama dynasty, of which the present king is Rama the Ninth, King Bhumibol Adulyadej, Rama the Ninth, came from a royal line that rose to power in 1782, the year that Bangkok was founded as the new capital of the kingdom as a result of a war with Burma. And one of the first things that Rama the First did was to establish diplomatic relations with the United States. When Americans went over to Europe and talked to the French, who had been their allies in the war with Britain, the French said, "Shall we send you 13 ambassadors or one?" Which was hardly the diplomatic way to deal with America. But the Thais recognized something in this country. And indeed, in few countries of the world is there such a remarkable appreciation, for good or evil, because not everything that we export abroad is good, and the Thais try to choose the good from the evil and haven't always been able to distinguish the two when it comes out of this country. But indeed, whereas some nations would like to destroy this country, there's no question we have enemies in the world. One country that is not our enemy is Thailand. It is a country that had sense enough at the end of the Vietnam War to simply tell Americans to go home. Because Thailand was a friend of the United States, they told us to leave. After we left, then they told us we can come back as individuals, but we don't want military bases in our country. If we're going to be friends with you, they said, you cannot have military bases in our land. There will always be somebody who will point out that you are here and taking advantage of us. Many others of our friends, like the Filipinos, and many are not wise enough to do that. First place, we wouldn't want to get out. The Thais had strength enough to tell us to go. And we've been friends ever since. When we begin to build military bases, we think we have friends in the Arab world. The longer we stay there, the more we'll have enemies. Among those who have been our friends, the man, the Prime Minister, who sent the Americans packing out of Thailand, I've been in his home, a remarkable person. We were introduced to him in 1971. And he had very good common sense. He saw that if we stayed there, they would have problems. And those problems would not exist if we were told simply to leave and go home. We were allowed to be there during the Vietnam War. But when that was over, we had to leave, and that was right. Sometime we'll learn the principles of wisdom better than most people. Recently, there was a coup in Thailand. The United States government roundly spoke out against the military takeover of the government, which was a civilian government, not a military government. Well, we knew that was, of course, quite different because we're in close contact with the Thai community in Southern California as well as in Thailand itself. The Thai government that was civilian and elected was democratic, all right, and it had come to be corrupt. And the military waited and waited and finally took action and removed it. The king held his peace for a while and then simply told the United States, what was done was for the good of Thailand. No one was killed in the revolution. The military simply took over, does not intend to tolerate corruption at that high level of government. Now, that's not the democratic way as we think of it here. But in that country, the military are concerned about the welfare of the royal family, the welfare of the nation, and are not like military leaders in the bulk of Latin America. You will not see bodies in Thailand chopped up here by the rightists and here by the leftists, as you can see in El Salvador. You don't have mass graves as you have in Argentina and other places. It's simply a different world. And the United States does not understand fully that not every country thinks like we do or ought to. Anyway, our brethren are doing all right. The Karen refugees on the border between Thailand and what used to be Burma or is now the Republic of Myanmar. So far, they have survived. We have a plan. Dr. Pisit Vorauri recently came to visit our campus on behalf of His Majesty's work in flower and trees. Flowers and trees. You know, most royal families are concerned about the welfare of the country. And Dr. Pisit is a very, very fine, competent person. My wife and I had a chance to enjoy his company. We are working to find especially palm tree seeds of different varieties for developing in Thailand. And he made a proposal. You see, what we did was to use foundation money to buy a property in Thailand, and as foreigners, we cannot hold it. So we turned it over to Sawat Yingyuad, who was our employee from late 1971, a very fine person who died now more than 2 years ago. And he therefore received the property from monies of the foundation and invited the Karen members of the Church of God to live on that land and to make a living there. He had the approval of the government, the governor of Tak province, to do so. He died, and the land, in a sense, fell into controversy between his brother and ourselves, in the sense of who does own it, because it was the foundation money. So it's been a problem, and Dr. Pisit said that in his judgment, the way to solve the problem in order that these people can live safely there is simply to donate this property to the king. Of course, we know the king. The king loves us and would not feel out of place addressing you. So by turning it over to the royal family, he becomes, in a sense, the protector of anybody who lives on property that's donated to him, and nobody will lay a hand on it. That is the apparent solution to the problem. It's not easy to be a refugee, but it takes, you know, we couldn't decide these things. It takes people who have some knowledge of Thai law and Thai customs to know what to do. So I want to thank those of you who prepared, besides the more standard American fare, from artichokes to beans, the lovely cuisine. I thought this was a very nice luncheon occasion. I very much appreciate getting to know you in that way. You are a people here that are not narrow in your view. There are some areas of this country where people are very narrow and simply wouldn't do or tackle anything but what you have done for decades. But this is a little different, and I think that's to complement this area of the state of Washington. My wife and I had no idea that we would find so many desert rats here. No, we knew they lived in California because we had there was a program years ago on radio, Death Valley Days. In Oregon, you had your covered wagon days, and I don't know what you had up here in Washington, but it is amazing how arid this has become once one leaves the Olympic chain on the West Coast. It's a remarkable world. And I think my wife and I can say we are impressed with what can be done here. But unfortunately, when I hear that the bulk of people who work on a farm have been reduced to farm labor, as distinct from small farm owners, that we are, of course, at a point in agriculture that is it's an ultimate disaster. That's what it is. James, in his book, addresses that fact. He points up that the laborer who reaps the field is the one who ultimately pays the penalty. That is, he is to reap the field properly and to care for land properly is a very important thing. And we are doing this in such a mechanical way at such low wages in California and here, undoubtedly, that James, in a sense, was looking down prophetically and seeing that one of the most oppressed people would be those who reap our own land. Instead of the farm owner and his family doing it, we have reduced agriculture to a necessary export cash crop. I was reading where if our wine vats are full, and if our olive wine yards are full and olive vats are full, that we're supposed to be blessed. The Psalms speak of these things. Today, if these things are full, the price is depressed. And you're not blessed. You're cursed. This is wrong. And that's due to the fact that the idea is that you have to sell your product because you're producing too many things on the basis of agribusiness and monocropping. Monocropping huge areas devoted to a single crop that is so competitive. When I grew up in Northern California, I took agriculture in high school. I got sick and tired of it, castrating little pigs and things like that. So there were other things. But I was in agriculture, which has stood me in good stead because the bulk of men in the ministry today haven't had agriculture. They have only opened egg cartons. They have never actually taken care of chicken roosts. It's just a reality. They don't know. There's one man operating the television camera when we did something on a farm in Thailand. He said, "Now, what is this man going to do next?" Well, the answer is what every farmer would do, but he never saw a farmer. And so it has been of some help. But when I grew up, we would think of nothing other than there were maybe 120 varieties of apples that were being grown. Now we can reduce the varieties of apples to about 8 on the marketplace in general, unless you're exporting or importing something from New Zealand. But it's too bad. We have a place out my wife and I should like to visit in Northern California. I was mentioning this to one of the members here at our table at noon, that they grow heirloom apples, some 200 varieties. Heirloom apples are those apples which represent what earlier generations grew. And they are preserving this breeding stock. But today we're producing on a vast scale so many of the almost the same kind of product that unless you can market yours early, picking it greener, you know what I mean, instead of when it ought to be at its full peak of ripeness, and then you have to ship it so far that all these things drive the price down. And correctly been stating it, but carefully, because we didn't have a chance to go all through our literature and edit it. What is important to remember is that Jesus said of his temple, of his body, that he would be dead, and in 3 days he would raise it up. Then he also said that he would be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. We did not know, and Mr. Armstrong did not grasp, that at that time there were two different 3 days period of time. One from the time of his burial, and one from the time of his death. And he died and remained on the cross hours, if he was dead by 3:30. Because from noon to 3 o'clock it was dark. And then they offered him the vinegar, and then they speared him. So he was dead by 3:30. It was that evening Joseph of Arimathea came to Pilate and said, I'd like the body of Jesus. And they sent out the men to check whether it was so or not, but he was dead. Pilate was surprised. And then they took it and buried it. And it says that Joseph was rolling the stone in front of it. And it says, and the Sabbath drew on. The Revised Standard Version correctly has, and the Sabbath had begun. This was somewhere between sunset and dark. The Sabbath had already begun. In that period of time. In other words, what had happened, in plain and simple terms, is that we had overlooked for years that there were two distinct periods of 3 days that are involved. One, from the moment of his death, he would rise from the dead. He would rise from the dead 3 days after he was slain. That means in essentially mid-afternoon, after 3 p.m. on Saturday, he rose from the dead. But he was not buried till, now he was buried before sunset, but the tomb was not shut and sealed until the Sabbath had already begun, the annual Sabbath, Wednesday night, essentially, not only after sunset, but at dark, at nightfall. The new day had begun. 3 days later, Wednesday evening to Thursday evening, Thursday to Friday evening, Friday to Saturday evening. Saturday evening, he rose from the tomb. So he remained in the tomb from the middle of the afternoon till nightfall on Saturday. And hence, Mark says very plainly, and having risen early the first day of the week, not when he had risen, literally the Greek is having risen early the first day of the week. Jesus did not leave the tomb until the first day had begun. Not in the morning. A day begins at nightfall, doesn't it? Every day begins at nightfall. Romans beginning at midnight. So Jesus rose from the tomb at the beginning when that wave sheaf was cut. The tomb held him until 3 days and three nights had elapsed. And 3 days and three nights from the time that tomb was sealed, shut, not sealed by the Pharisees, but Joseph of Arimathea had closed it, rolled a stone. Jesus was there for some, probably 4 hours, based on the fact this was April 25, 26, you see, late April. He remained in the tomb some 4 hours and left the tomb. Hours, a few hours, several hours, whatever term you'd like to use as an adjective, after he had risen from the dead. And he left the tomb. And he did not ascend to the Father, however, until the next morning, which you're familiar with. So now we discover that not only was Jesus the Lamb of God, we discover that Jesus was like that wave sheet that was cut. When that wave sheet was cut, it was removed from the earth, no longer held by it. Jesus could now leave the tomb in fulfillment at that time.
We know that he did because it was 3 days and three nights, and the tomb was not originally closed until the Sabbath had begun. That's the meaning of the Revised Standard Version out of the Greek, Luke's account. Therefore, Jesus fulfilled the wave sheaf and rose from the tomb, and the next morning, when the high priest waved or presented the sheaf of barley at the altar, Jesus presented himself to God the Father in heaven. Early that morning, he told Mary, "Don't touch me." And later that morning, just a little later, he said to the women, "Go tell the disciples," and the women grasped his feet, and Jesus didn't say anything. Perfectly all right, because he had already been accepted of the Father as that wave sheet. And so the remarkable thing is, now we have a picture very clear. We have the proper understanding of when the original sacrifice and all the ceremonies pertaining to the Passover occurred. We have an understanding of that cutting of the wave sheaf, its presentation, Jesus rising from the dead and his rising from the tomb, one at the end of the Sabbath, the other at the beginning of the first day of the week. And then the next morning, he presented himself. So instead of having to argue with Mark, who says that having risen early the first day of the week, Jesus did so and so, Mark was actually telling the rest of the story. Not when he rose from the dead, but when he rose from the tomb. And we simply didn't know how to deal with this for years. If this is the Church of God, the Church of God does not have to stagnate. We should grow and mature, and indeed, we have been the last 5 years. Now, there are a few things we'll undoubtedly have to correct yet, and other things we'll discover. Some things will be set aside. Perhaps it shouldn't be. Every administration makes its decisions. Is it not perfect? The Church of God is not perfect, never has been. No husband is perfect, no wife is perfect. If any of you think your mate is perfect, I want to talk to you. And meet this divinity of whom we were speaking. Is that clear? Everybody. All right. Without being offensive, we just have to realize we all have flaws. We could have presented some of these things to Mr. Armstrong, but often the missing link simply wasn't there, where we knew we couldn't be convincing, because although the rest of the picture was clear, the biggest problem, the biggest hurdle, was to understand when a day properly began. That was the biggest hurdle. And once that fell into place, then all the rest of these essentially present no problem. So now we are dealing with Pentecost today. You've had a nice presentation to show what God promises the church. I would merely say that Mr. Smith does not remember whether he gave a sermon on this topic here or only at a previous area. But there were seven lamps on one candelabra in the Old Testament. There were seven periods of churches, let's say of church government in the history of ancient Israel. In a simple summary, just as there are seven stages in the church today, as we look at the New Testament history, there was the government of God in the days of Moses and Joshua that established the country. And then the next was the government of God under the judges. Then the government of God when the nation was united under a king or kings. And then it was divided into two countries. So now we have four. Then it was under the governors of the Persians and early Greece, that's five. Then under the Maccabean priest kings, that's six. And finally, the scribes and Pharisees sat in Moses' seat, that's seven. Seven periods of time, the government was quite distinct. Absolutely distinct. You can't mistake the fact. So today, the church, inevitably, is like the New Testament church. In the New Testament church, it began with Ephesus. And clearly, it had already developed into a situation where you had Ephesus and Smyrna together. When you look at the story, the final separation didn't occur until 325. In AD 325, the brethren who represented Smyrna were kicked out. But the church of Smyrna had already begun in the second century, while the bulk of Ephesus was still being represented of people who were losing their first love. So half the church observed the traditional practices and the other half had not. Most people don't really understand that, in fact, those two congregations were side by side till a certain period of time. And in the same way, the Philadelphia era of the church correctly should be understood as having begun in the last century. The Sardis era was over with the end of the Seventh-day, ending with the Seventh-day Baptist movement, and the people who were called out by William Miller led to that group of people whom we recognize as Philadelphia. I mistakenly call it Sardis. Perhaps some of the people were like it too, just like today we have people like that, or any other church era, or church congregation, shall we call it. But Mr. Armstrong became a member of the Church of God Seventh Day. And he was a part of a group of people who were small and had little strength. And this work was small when it began to sprout out under his further leadership. 1940s and 50s, and, you know, we were there, it was poor. But we have grown. This world is so transformed between 1930, 40, and 50, till this world is rich, increased with goods, and full of debt. Never have we prospered so much with so much debt. And that's the way the world is. The world is essentially Laodicean. The world of the last century that endured the Civil War, the world of this early part of this century that endured World War I and World War II and the crises afterwards, those were hard times. Times of faith, times of endurance. Some branches of the Church of God Seventh Day simply did not grow. God said of the Philadelphia Church something we haven't fully understood adequately. He said, "I will open a door that no man can shut." We forget to read, "I will shut a door no man can open." Now, God opened the door and nobody has shut it with respect to this work. But with respect to the other branches of the Church of God, God shut the door and nobody has been able to open it. They are not being used in the same way anymore. And then finally this work grows and grows till the bulk of the people who are being called are called out of the world that is Laodicean. That's the world around us, whether we like it or not. It's a world increased with good such that our parents and grandparents never experienced it. When we think we hardly have need of anything else, we are rich and increased with goods, and then we look at all our debts. You ever wonder how many debts the Japanese have, how many debts the Germans, this country, everybody? It's built on credit. Credit is available because you go into debt. Do you ever think about that? The credit that you have is what is extended to you as a debt to be paid. That's essentially the way this world operates. All right. So indeed, Mr. Armstrong told Mr. DeCosh, told all of us, that indeed, that we are at that stage when the dominant number of people who are being called into the church today represent another way of life. People who are being called today as a whole never endured World War I, certainly. Most of them were born long after the Depression. Many of them were not even born during the time of World War II or the Korean War. I don't know what students think when they, if they say, well, if I tell them, well, I went to Ambassador College beginning in 1947. So 1947, essentially, for some of these people, represents childhood for their parents. Childhood for their parents. And it's a different world. So today we should expect that indeed we are prosperous. The church has now greater prosperity than before. We are in a time, of course, when money doesn't have the same meaning because of inflation. Small inflation, but nevertheless enduring inflation. But Mr. Armstrong recognized that the church had already become like Laodicea as a whole. Because the fact remains that the world had prospered on debt, and the world was blind to a lot of the things it was doing. If it were not blind, it would not have gone in the direction of the new morality that it did. If it were not blind, it would not have gone in the direction of drugs. In general, in areas like New York, New Jersey, Southern California, the bulk of people who are being called into the church now under age 35, who did not grow up and stay directly within the confines of the local congregation, have all done the drug scene. In New York City, there's not a single person now being called, based on the last conversation with the minister, not a single person who has been off of drugs all his life. They have all been on drugs who are under 40 years of age who are being called. More or less. All the young people, or almost all in Southern California, who left the church and are now coming back, have done the drug thing. You tell me that they were not blind. That's the way the world is. That's why it's doing these things. All right, those people are being called. The lay of the sea, like anybody else, can repent. God just simply tells you, like you put ice out, so you begin to see. By gold that's tried in the fire, that is, by something that's worthwhile. That's what he's saying. Put value on that which is worthwhile, not which is corrupt. Gold that has been tested by fire is gold that's purified, not something that's ersatz or corrupt. But the world today is simply representing people. Some of these people are fully repentant, and others simply are not. And so God tells the Laodiceans that they should do these things to repent. And every church period makes its contribution. Every church period makes its contribution. If there were no new things understood by the church today, I would have to say, we have yet a whole era of the church to go. But the fact is that new understanding has come to every church. And indeed, we're side by side. There'll come a time when there'll be, tragically, a separation. Not the separation that you might think about. The bulk of those who represent Philadelphia will be dead. They've been dying in the last century and in this century. People whom I knew in the late 40s, 50s, 60s are gone. We're in the 90s. Mr. Armstrong's generation is gone. My mother was a member, she's gone. Long ago, these things have happened. All right. Laodiceans, like anybody else, can repent. There will be some who will escape the crisis to come and some who won't. The bulk of Philadelphia will certainly escape those who are alive. But there'll be some, represented by people like the Church of God Seventh Day, who won't. The door was shut in front of them and was never opened, and God couldn't use them. God says, don't let anybody take your crown. Somebody's going to take their crown. What have they done with their lives? They've been publishing the magazine since the 1860s, and they don't have any more than 12,000 on the subscription list. Think about it. And the other branch has about 3,000 to 4,000. Salem, West Virginia. One of you came from that group. What has been done is dead. In that sense, they'd have some characteristics like Farnett. But they simply have let somebody else do the job, and they haven't been able to do it because, sometimes people stop growing. And so we have a situation where today we simply have to recognize that we are in a period of time that Mr. Armstrong knew was already beginning by 72. He could see the state of the church had now become characteristically dominant by the new society. He wrote the article in the book, God Speaks Out on the New Morality, and he saw promiscuous sex, drugs, and this has simply gotten worse and worse in society. Look at divorce, everything. And we have people coming out of that kind of the Laodicean world around us. Remember, the churches in each of those seven cities represented the...